Good day, friends. Jonathan Darty here with another edition of the PSR Podcast. You know, we're a listener-supported outreach of Be Broken Ministries, and we exist to help individuals and families move from sexual brokenness to wholeness in Christ and equip others to do the same. In this episode, I chat with Hadley Baker, who courageously shares his journey through sexual addiction and its impact on his life as a pastor. Hadley opens up about his childhood trauma as a result of an unwanted pregnancy, believing that he was unlovable. Then came the early onset of his addiction to pornography and the eventual internal conflict of living a double life while in ministry. He recounts pivotal moments such as his spiritual awakening, the challenges in his marriage, and his path to healing through counseling and truly understanding God's love. We also highlight the importance of authenticity and open discussions within the church to support anyone struggling with unwanted sexual behaviors. Hadley's story is a powerful reminder of the need for grace, hope, and compassion. To learn more about Hadley and get his book, No Longer a Slave, visit hadleybaker.com. For additional resources, visit bebroken.org or check out all of the links that we're going to put in today's show notes. And of course, friends, we would ask that you rate and review the podcast after listening to help others find it. Now, let's dive into today's inspirational and insightful conversation with Hadley. Well, all right, we've got Hadley Baker with us today. So welcome, Hadley.
Hey, thanks to be here.
Yeah, no problem.
Sorry, great to be here.
Yeah,
I don't know if you want to edit that out.
Hey, man, I'm sorry. We don't do editing around here because it's all about being authentic. So we're
you got my authentic version. Thanks to be here. Great to be here.
That's right. Yeah, it's kind of like there was a comedian, Brian Regan, and he said he has this little bit where he goes, you know, take luck, where he meant to, you know, say, you know, take care, and then he said good luck, but he just put them together, take luck. So. Anyway, I was excited to have you on the program because you had reached out to us and you've written a book that we're going to talk about a little bit later, kind of outlining your story, especially your story as a pastor who has dealt with your own personal sexual struggles. And I love having pastors on because I feel like, you know, sometimes in the church when we have those who have been called into ministry, and when they have a personal struggle with any kind of sexual brokenness, it's almost as if we have this reaction. And I think part of it, there's a righteousness to it of saying, hey, there is a higher standard that a leader is called to in this. And so, but we have this idea of never again could they ever be of use in God's kingdom.
Right.
Because they failed in such a way. But I would love for our listeners and viewers to hear your story. And I want us to kind of then go through a little bit of what you've learned, and then we'll talk about how you've, you know, kind of codified that into a book that can help people really break free from their unwanted sexual behaviors.
Yeah, for sure. And man, thank you for having me on. It is great to be with you. And man, kudos to you for having these conversations. I think the church needs to have more of them. That's certainly the way I try to lead at City on a Hill, the church that I pastor here in Northeast Dallas. But, you know, I tell people my story of sexual addiction, particularly in the area of pornography. As crazy as it sounds, I believe it began before I was actually even born. And the reason I say that is because I was an unplanned pregnancy. And when I was born in the late 70s, my biological father was missing in action to this day. And I'll actually be, from the time we're recording this, I'll actually be 47 in less than a week. I to this day don't know for sure who my biological father is. And so I feel like that kind of set the stage for a lot of issues that would manifest in my life, particularly in the formative years of my life. As a child, issues of identity, self-worth, just that confidence that a young boy needs instilled into him by his father. And that deposit was never made. And so I grew up just with this kind of this instinctive feeling that something's wrong with me. Something's not right here. Where's my dad? And my mom being so young, you know, she was 17 when I was born and she did the very best that she could. And, you know, my grandfather was in the picture. He helped out. But man, there was just that wounding that happened. You know, the fact that my father chose to not be in my life just jammed me up. And so I already had a lot of, I think, deep-seated beliefs, even if they weren't conscious, you know, they were inside me. And then at a very young age, I got exposed to porn. Right around kindergarten, first grade, I had seen, you know, the softer stuff like your Playboys, but then I had also come across harder things in magazine at this time. And, you know, whether it was a kid in my apartment community or relatives that had magazines in their home, there seemed to just always be opportunities, if I can use that word, for exposure. Mm-hmm. And so fast forward to when I'm 10 years old, my mom made the decision, just given the fact that my childhood had been less than ideal. There had been a lot of struggle in our home. You know, she had been married and divorced, and my stepdad, there was just a lot of issues there that I won't go into right now. But the short version, Jonathan, is when I was 10 years old, my mom and I had a conversation about me moving to Texas from Oklahoma and moving in with my aunt and uncle and them adopting me, basically taking me in as their son. And it would be a legal binding adoption to where I would take their last name, you know, even the verbiage in the home. You know, I went from aunt and uncle to mom and dad, and it would be a permanent, you know, transition. And she did that with the heart of letting me start over and kind of hit the reset button. And I know now as an adult, her motives in that. But, you know, as a 10-year-old child, particularly when you factor in that at this time, I had two younger brothers who had come along, and both of my brothers stayed with my mom for reasons that I mentioned in the book that were justifiable. But to me, at the age of 10, you know, the message that was sent to me was, man, my biological father didn't want me. My stepdad, my mom had married, was in and out. He didn't want me. And now my own mom, you know, this is the lie I believe the enemy spun. And man, I took it hook, line, and sinker, where I believed this lie at a very young age. And I mean, I believed it to the core of me. Hadley, you are not lovable. You're not lovable. I mean, these people in your life that should love you more than anyone, even they don't love you. And man, I cannot even articulate just the level of shame and insecurity and just loathing that I felt about my very self. And so right around this time after I moved, there's a kid on my street, and I use the word friend very loosely, whose father had a shed in their backyard with stacks and stacks. That, man, there had to be hundreds of hardcore pornographic magazines. And this kid, one day we're hanging out, and he says, hey, come here. And he takes me into the shed, and the shed was never locked. And so it became a period for several years where I would sneak in and out of that shed. I wouldn't even tell the kid that I was going down there, but I had free access. It was almost like a library, you know, and in the book, I refer to it as the smut hut, right? It was this place I would sneak into and borrow magazines and then take them home. And then around that same time, another friend, his dad has movies. And at the age of 12, I was first exposed to hardcore pornographic films. I had never seen pornography in a movie form, only in print. Mm-hmm. And I will never forget just the rush and the high of the, you know, the adrenaline and the dopamine that surged through me when I went to that level. And it just continued to escalate. And then there was another friend in middle school. I mean, it was just like all these people coming into my life who just kept leading me deeper into this world. And by the time I was in eighth grade, I would say I was, by like clinical definition, you know, when you look at the compulsive behavior, the obsession, the deception, lying and sneaking around, like I had all the markers of addiction. And so here I am in eighth grade, hooked on porn. I'm 14 years old. And man, it not only was something I did, it was something that had become, I would say, in my understanding at that time, almost necessary for me to survive. And the reason I say that, and to some of your listeners, I think this will make a lot of sense, was it was a gateway for me to a world where I was never rejected. It was a world where I felt wanted. And one of the things I did really quickly was I formed what I call virtual bonding with these female pornographic performers, where I learned their names, which are obviously not their real names, but I felt this real attachment to them, where literally when I would be searching out pornography, I wouldn't just want to watch generic porn. I would want to find these specific performers by name, and I felt a connection to them. And when I'm watching these other men on the screen, you know, having sex with them, it was almost as I was living vicariously through these males. Sure. And like I was bonding and I was attaching and I was the one being accepted and feeling wanted. And some people may think that's crazy, but man, when you don't love yourself, man, you will do anything to escape that sense of self-loathing. And it was just this perfect storm of my own brokenness with the right people in my life introducing me to porn. And then, you know, the opportunity to just keep going back to it. And it just hooked me and grabbed hold of me. And crazy.
Yeah, and all of this. So first of all, lots of trauma in your life in terms of just abandonment trauma. And certainly you're trying to find an outlet for being able to handle emotions that you probably couldn't have even articulated during those years. You're feeling them, but probably not even knowing how to express them. That's or anything like right. that. Where along your life or where in your life or when in your life, were you introduced to Jesus? Like, where did Jesus come into the story in your life?
So you couldn't have timed that question any better. So literally the summer after eighth grade, I'm 14 years old, and my biological grandfather, my mom's dad, who had really been the only father figure I had ever had growing up. And since my dad wasn't in the picture and my mom was so young, most of my childhood was spent in the home of my grandparents. And my grandfather, I talk about him in the book, there's a whole chapter devoted to him. His name's Richard Morgan. And I had a front row seat since I lived in his home. I had a front row seat to his relationship with Jesus. He was the most devout man I have ever known in my life. Like, who he was at church is who he was at home. Like, Jesus wasn't a detail. Like, Jesus was the center. In the book, I say it that, you know, some people give Jesus lip service. My grandfather gave him life service. Like, he followed him wholeheartedly. And so there were a lot of seeds that were planted during those formative years. And at the age of 14, when my grandfather passed, it was a tremendous blow to me because I felt like, man, this is the only person that I ever really rested in the fact that he loved me and he's gone. And as crazy as it sounds, it was actually at his funeral, June 30th, 1992. I'm 14 years old. I'm standing next to his casket in this little country church in Southern Oklahoma. And I just, man, I just told the Lord, I said, I don't know what all I'm going to have to do in my life, but like I surrender. And I looked at my grandfather. I said, I promise you, I'll see you in heaven someday. And I knew that, if I was going to have the hope of eternal life, that I had to confess, I had to repent, I had to turn from this pathway that I was on. And it was a very real experience. And it was what I would call a Damascus Road type experience, where the change was instant. It was radical. So much so that 1 year to the day, the next summer, I'm 15 years old. And I pleaded with my youth pastor to let me preach in our Wednesday night service. And I don't know if he saw a calling on my life or if I just annoyed him to the point that he finally gave in. But for whatever reason, he allowed me to speak. And man, I rode home that night, 15 years old, and I just knew, like, man, this is what I'm going to do the rest of my life. And there was a period there for about 2 years. Man, I didn't look at porn. I had no desire to look at porn. And then it wasn't until my junior year I had my first, what most of your listeners will understand the language of a relapse, where I went back to porn. And one of the things I say sometimes in my speaking and my writing is I tell young people and I caution young people, you know, when the devil comes and he knocks on your door, you need to know this, like he's not coming to visit, he's coming to stay. Like his bags are packed and he's moving in. Like he's not dropping by, he wants to take up residency. And I reconnected with one of those old friends from middle school, go to his house, he gives me a movie, and I find myself almost just instantly back in that space of using pornography. But now I'm very conflicted, right? Because I'm a Christian. I now have this reputation as this young preacher. I'm leading a Bible study on my high school campus. I'm speaking my youth group. I even had pastors from other churches, like not even just youth pastors, like senior pastors, calling me like they'd heard about this teenage preacher from Texas and saying, hey, will you come and speak to our youth? Or, hey, I'm will you come on this Sunday night service or whatever? And man, it was this pressure I feel now of like, man, I can't tell anyone about this because I felt like I finally had a sense of identity. Like I'm finally somebody, something I can be proud of. And man, if I let people know I'm struggling in this way, man, the only bright spot in my life is going to be taken from me.
And you know, Hadley, I can only imagine too, because that's an extreme contrast from what you experienced in terms of abandonment from your childhood is now you're inside this faith family and all of a sudden you're wanted.
You matter.
Right? And so there's a sense in which I can only imagine what that felt like to go, don't do anything to get off this train. Don't do anything to derail this. And so what did that look like maybe for the next years in ministry and life in terms of trying to navigate this newfound, you know, family, this newfound calling, and yet at the same time, man, you're back struggling with these secret sins.
Man, it was the most intense form of conflict you can imagine, internally speaking. I remember the day I turned 18, like my literal 18th birthday, I made my first trip to an adult bookstore. And I became really proficient, and it sounds maybe ironic to say this, I became really good at living a double life. The conflict never went away. I knew it was wrong. I hated that it was wrong. I didn't want to do it, but I felt powerless when those compulsions would come over me. I felt powerless to resist it. And so somewhere along the way, I just kind of made peace where I just said, listen, this is who you are. This is as much a part of you as your eye color, your hair color. This is your DNA. You are an addict. Yes, you have the ability to preach. And yes, God has called you, but this is just how it is. And I really believe that. And so, you know, for the rest of my high school years, I lived in secrecy. I went off to a Christian university thinking, being in this Bible bubble, my urges and compulsions would just dissipate, and they didn't. If anything, moving to the Metroplex gave me more opportunity to be even more secretive because there's a whole slew of adult establishments in the Metroplex that I can sneak off to and visit. And so literally, as I'm preparing for ministry, the struggle not only continued, but actually worsened, that I began in college having sexual, physical relationships with females. And there was always intense remorse and regret, and I would weep. And it was this constant vacillating between striving to live righteously, but then just feeling, it was like this war of attrition where I just felt wore down and I finally would give in, and then I would feel bad and I would hate myself and punish myself and beat myself up. And it was just this back and forth. And so then I said, well, once I'm in full-time ministry, it'll just go away. Once I'm working at a church, I'm preaching, I'm teaching, I'm leading students, it's going to go away. And so when I started working at a really, really prominent church here in Northeast Dallas, like one of the best opportunities I could have hoped for. And for a few months, it subsided. But then all of those things inside of me that I don't even know if I understood what they were, but there was just something, it was almost magnetic. There was this brokenness inside of me that the only way I knew to sedate those feelings was through porn. And so here I am now working at a church. I'm looking at porn. And sometimes I would even look at it on my own church computer, or I would sneak off to adult bookstores. But the secrecy continued to metastasize. It just grew and grew and grew to where it reached a point where, man, I just couldn't manage it. But then it escalated to greater forms of behavior to where it even moved to the place of probably one of the crazier stories in the book that I would tell you, but I actually got an accidental phone call. Someone dialed the wrong number and called me, and it was an escort prostitute. And she was calling, asking for someone by the name of Steve. I'm like, Steve's not here. She tells me who she is and what she's about. And I mean, I literally, when I say the devil knows your number, he really, in that case, he absolutely did. I mean, just crazy stuff like that, where I'm driving down the road and I see something flapping in the middle of the road and I pull over and it's a pornographic magazine. I mean, just, it was like just opportunities constantly put in front of me. But But I entered into this world of, strip clubs and massage parlors and escorts and prostitutes. And you know how addiction is. Once you kind of raise the bar on your experience, you're no longer content to go back to a previous bar that you had set. Mm-hmm. And the short version of it, obviously, there's a reason I wrote a book about it. It's a lot to unpack. But the short version is, I was under immense conviction. I hated the double life. I went to a man in the church who was and is, continues to be a good friend and mentor to me, a guy named Mike McMillan. And man, I vomited confession on him. I just let him hear everything I had done since I started working at the church. And 2 days later, we go to lunch and he says, man, you got to go tell pastor what you told me. And I was like, man, I don't know if you understand how this works, Mike. If I go and confess this, I'm going to immediately be terminated. I have disqualified myself from ministry. And I knew that. And he says, maybe, maybe not, but man, you need help, bro. You need help. You're trying to help all these other people. You need help because I'm worried about you. And he said something I'll never forget. He said, I think the hook is deeper in you than you even realize. Like, mm-hmm. You know, you're messed up. I don't know if you know how messed up you are, how broken you are. And so I said, well, if we're going to do it, let's do it now. If we wait even a day, I won't do it. And so we went straight to my pastor and instantly I was let go. And I found myself at 24 years old at this time. This is back in 2002. You know, I was a student pastor. I lost my ministry. And I thought to myself, how did I get here? And how did something that began, you know, with exposure in such a young age of my life, how did I get to this place where this is costing me big time? Like this addiction is causing me real pain. And man, it was devastating, you know, to have to step away from ministry and the shame and the embarrassment. I mean, just, it wrecked my life. It was mm-hmm. very heartbreaking.
Now at this point, were you married yet at this point?
I was not. And what's crazy is 3 weeks to the day of my final service at the church that I had to resign from, I met Christy, the woman I'm now married to. And that's a funny story that I won't unpack, but basically the short version is she was working at the apartments where I was living. And I was in the business center one day and her coworkers, you know, basically played matchmaker and introduced us. And we dated for 2 years and got engaged and then we got married. And I believe what I know a lot of your listeners and viewers believed. Once I get married, my struggles with porn are going to go away. I know you've never heard that one, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And just like when I was in Bible college, just like at the church, when I started working at the church, it was this period of, because it was new, I had a couple months of sobriety and freedom. And then I fell back into those patterns. And man, I was probably 2 years into the marriage and my wife had found enough stuff online where I thought I'd cleared my browsing history and I hadn't. Or I would go and buy DVDs and in the rush of the moment, I wasn't thinking clearly. And I put the receipt in my pocket and she's doing laundry and finds a receipt for some title of some raunchy DVD. I mean, there was enough of those incidents. And my wife had come from a broken home because her father had an addiction and her father had actually had an extramarital affair that split their home apart. So what I dismissed as just a common male struggle, you know, every guy struggles with this.
Sure, yeah.
She saw it as, no, this is the beginning of our marriage heading down a path that's going to end in divorce. And so she sat me down one day and just very graciously but very firmly said, listen, I love you. I want to be with you, but I can't stay. Like, this hurts me so deeply. Like, I can't stay in this. And that was probably one of the, what I would call a big come to Jesus moment where I'm like, man, I've already lost my ministry. Am I willing to lose this woman? Like, and I loved her deeply and she was perfect for me. Like, we have so many wonderful things that complement each other. Like, bro, are you really gonna roll the dice on this? Like, I mean, come on, man. And it was the beginning of a process that when it really hit home was on my 30th birthday. We went to the doctor and I heard the sonogram. My wife was pregnant with our daughter. And on my 30th birthday, I heard this heartbeat. And man, it just became real to me. I'm like, man, I have the power to be a blessing or a burden to my child. And I know the power that fathers have to bless or burden their kids because of my own experience. Yeah. I don't even know. And so it scared me. I'm like, man, am I going to pass this brokenness off to my kids? And it was scary because I wanted to change. I just, man, I didn't know how. I didn't think I could, because that had been a part of my life for so long. It's like, man, how I want to, but how? And that was the beginning of a process that began to manifest and I talk about that a lot in the book, of just the journey that God set me on for healing.
So let's talk about what kind of bringing up to current date, like what did it take to finally get to a point where, okay, you have discovered that you have to live in a completely different way, not just keep, you know, slapping some, you know, heartfelt tear induced repentance and things that feel like, hey, I'm just thinking that I'm going to white knuckle it. And when did you start to realize that there had to be a paradigm shift? Like the foundation of how you do life is different today than when you were entangled in pornography?
Sure. That's an awesome question. Obviously, everyone has their own journey. I will say for me, a tremendous, tremendous part of my pathway was through counseling. I did not love myself. I did not love myself. And one of the things I say in the book is, you know, is that you will never fight for your freedom if you believe you are unworthy of it. And I did not understand that in the cross and in the gospel of Jesus Christ, that Jesus did more to you know, than give me a get out of hell ticket, right? He did more than just save me for eternity, but that he wants to bring freedom and wholeness to me in this life. But I struggle with that. I had projected onto God the same wounds I had received from my father. I didn't understand that he loved me. I didn't understand he was for me. I didn't understand grace and mercy and compassion. And I viewed God as someone I had to earn his love and earn his affection. And so for me, a proper healing in my understanding of God was vital, to see him as being for me rather than being up there with his arms crossed, you know, shaking his head in disgust, just tolerating me begrudgingly. That was paramount. But then also discovering a healthy love of self. And for me, man, it was so critical in that healing journey, because I didn't love myself. And some of your listeners will understand that, Jonathan, man, that when you don't love yourself, man, you will treat yourself so poorly. You don't care if you're addicted. You don't care if you mess your life up. Subconsciously, you feel like this is what I deserve. And so for me, it wasn't like a one and done. It was a process. But man, God had to do a deep work of healing. There's a lot of things I had to unlearn and new things I had to establish. And of course, you know, you've got all these peripheral, you know, ancillary tools that come with that. I mean, it's having the right people around you. You got to have good community. Obviously, the holy disciplines of studying scripture to renew your mind, prayer and communion with God. But really, for me, it sounds crazy. It sounds so simple. But man, understanding God's love for me, and that God did not create me. He did not put me on this planet to live as a slave. He wants me to live in freedom. And that as his son, I deserve to live in freedom. I'm a son of the Most High God. I'm not some bastard child whose father abandoned him, and I'm unworthy and I'm unlovable. And man, all those lies I had believed, when I began to see God rightly, I began to see myself rightly. And as I began to love myself, I began to want better for myself. And I'm like, I don't want this life anymore. I think you got to be practical in the things you shift, for sure.
Yeah, and I think I think it's really important to highlight the connection you're making there, because sometimes in our culture and on our world today, somebody can hear you say something, I had to learn to love myself. And there's right. All these wild, crazy ideas of what love even is. But I love the fact that you're making a very critical connection between the fact that you can't even know how to love yourself unless you understand the love that God has for you.
Absolutely.
You might even say it this way, and tell me if this would fit as well. You know, to love yourself is actually to see yourself through God's love for you.
Yeah.
So there's a sense, because some people will take that phrase, love yourself, and then they'll just go and say, how do I essentially just coddle myself? How do I essentially just say all my desires are right? Instead of going, no, when I actually understand that God knows me better than I know myself in all of my brokenness, and he says, I want you, I'll be faithful for you, I've forgiven you, then you go, could I see myself that way?
Yeah.
Could I actually have that same vantage point that he has?
Yeah.
And so tell me also then, not only the effect that that had, but then how then did you get back into ministry? Like, what did that look like? What did being a pastor look like after all of this brokenness?
Yeah. And to be clear, you know, losing my ministry happened in 2002. I mean, so we're talking about, you know, many years that have played out throughout this process. But when I lost my ministry, I transitioned into public education. I was a high school social studies teacher for 10 years. And then there was a really cataclysmic event in my life. The short version is, I told you I have two younger brothers, and my middle brother passed away. He was killed tragically in a car wreck. And it was actually at his funeral that I heard the voice of the Lord just say, what are you doing with your life? You know, my brother was 23 when he passed. I was 25 at that time. And I told the Lord, I'm like, what do you mean? And I just, it was like this reaffirmation of like, I've called you to ministry. And I'm like, you know, Lord, I don't know if you've maybe in ruling the cosmos, you've not been paying attention to what's going down here in my life, but I've made a big mess of things. And it was just this back and forth. Yes, but I've called you. I know, but I've screwed up. I know, but I've called you. And so I just told the Lord, I said, well, I don't know how this is going to be put back together because I've made a huge, huge mess of my life. It was a process that began as just guest speaking invitations. I did that for a period of 5 years where I just traveled and spoke primarily in youth groups. And then a church called me to be the student pastor. And I was there for a period of time and then transitioned to another church. And it was in 2018 that the Lord opened the door for Christy and I and our team to plant and start City on a Hill, which is a church that, you know, we felt God called us to birth and be a part of that. And so it wasn't just, you know, this, you know, one moment I had this encounter and, hey, let's go start a church. You know, it was, it was a gradual process of getting back and speaking and then student pastor, part-time student pastor, full-time. And then, you know what, let's go plant a church. And it's been a journey and it's been a process, but man, there's not a Sunday I don't step on that stage and say, Lord, thank you. Thank you for giving me another opportunity. And thank you for giving me a platform where I can talk to others. Because our church is real big. Real big on vulnerability and honesty. Like, I tell my story from the stage and I talk to people all the time. I said, listen, there's not a one of you in here that's going to ever need to feel like you need to hide. This is a place where we don't do that here. We don't hide. We don't live double lives. Here we bring it into the light. We expose it because as has been said, and I know you've heard this, you're only as sick as your secrets. So man, let's bring it into the light. Let's walk together. Let's get the right people in your life. Let's find out what the issues are. And I love it, man. Our church is just, I mean, some people find it honestly like awkward how honest we are, how real we are. And I always push back and say, no, this is what the people of God should be. Because all of us at the day, all of us need grace. All of us need forgiveness. Like, who among us doesn't? So let's quit walking around like we don't. Our brokenness may look different, but we're all in the same place. Let's just be honest about it.
So I want you, as we wrap up here, I want you to speak to two different individuals in our audience. First, I want you to speak to those who are still living their own double life, whatever that looks like. They have not brought themselves fully into the light. And what message of hope or challenge would you have to them? But the other person that I want you to talk to is anyone in our audience that is a pastor or they're a leader in ministry or they're engaged in their local church and say, okay, what would you say to them is necessary for bringing more light to this area in their local church? So what would you say first to the one who's living the double life and then also to the one who may be in leadership in their church?
Sure. Man, if you're living a double life as someone who lived in that place for a long, long time, I will just tell you don't have to do that anymore. And I think the fear that the enemy uses is to say, man, if I come forward, if I share this, if I open up, people are going to pull away from me. They're going to look at me differently. They're going to treat me differently. And what I have found in my journey is more often than not, is actually the opposite, where people feel endeared to you. They feel a connection. I heard somebody say one time, when we project and share our strengths, we create competition. But when we share our weaknesses, we create community. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to share that with someone that you trust and say, this is what's going on in my life. Listen, if you could have stopped on your own, if you could have quit on your own, it would have happened. The fact that it continues needs to be all the evidence that, you know, that's all the evidence you need to tell you, I need help. So take that first step. And I promise you, God will honor that. And there's a life waiting for you that you can't even imagine. To pastors and leaders, I would just say this, the issue is there. It's not going away. I mean, I read a Barna survey just recently of the number of professing Christians who struggle with porn is staggering, including pastors themselves. And so we have a choice to make. Are we going to stick our head in the sand and pretend it doesn't exist? Or are we going to foster and create an environment where people know, man, this is a common struggle, particularly for men, but not just for men. And man, if we're going to get free, we got to get real. And so people will only be as honest as they feel safe. So you have to create a safe place and create spaces in your church where these types of conversations can happen. And I believe the world would flock to churches if we offered hope in this area, because so many people, even outside the church, are so desperate to find freedom from this addiction.
That's awesome. And I'll tack on to that. We even have a little training that we can do for churches of helping them understand, how do you create what we call grace-based environments for exactly what you're talking about. So just there's resources available, and that's the good thing. Speaking of which, as we wrap up here, Hadley, share a little bit about your book and where people can get a copy of the book.
Yeah, well, so the book is called No Longer a Slave. It's literally my memoir and my journey. It's just, an expanded version of what we've talked about today. You can go to my website, hadleybaker.com, or you can just search for No Longer a Slave on Amazon. And it is my story, but in the last four chapters of the book, I give really practical, simple, easy to understand application steps of how you can begin to walk in freedom and not have to live as a slave to addiction. And so, I would be grateful for anyone who wanted to pick up a copy and pray it would be a blessing to you.
Yeah. Well, this has been really good, Hadley. Thanks for being on the program with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Jonathan.
Yeah. So listeners and viewers, we're going to put the link to Hadley's book in the show notes and some other resources that will help you, again, take your next best step towards wholeness in Christ. That's what we're here to help you do. And we're glad that you've been with us, and we look forward to seeing you back here again next time on the Pure Sex Radio program. Take care.
Pure Sex Radio is paid for by Be Broken Ministries. Visit us online at puresexradio.com.